Welcome back to Preacher Handshake. I'm Hannah.
And I'm Evan, and we're your hosts.
This week on Preacher Handshake, we talk with Reverend Aaron Coyle Carr.
Aaron joined the staff of First Baptist Moorhead, Kentucky, as a senior pastor in June of 2021. He served churches in North Carolina and Texas, and also completed a 2-year stint as a stay-at-home dad. Professionally, his passions include ecumenical and interfaith cooperation, robust and thoughtful patterns of Christian worship, and in-depth, contextually sensitive Bible study.
Aaron has a BA in Religion and Classics from Samford University and an MDiv from the Candler School of Theology at Emory University. He is married to Leanna, a minister, mother, and environmentalist, and together they have one daughter, Henley, who sometimes gleefully corrects his sermons from the front pew.
Aaron is a confessed nerd and can usually be found reading comic books or playing Dungeons and Dragons in his spare time. He also enjoys family hikes and splashing around in Cave Run Lake.
I really enjoyed our conversation with Aaron. I asked him to be on, honestly, because I found out about him through the news. He and his church are in Kim Davis's district. So if you have been following kind of some of the political things that are happening there, and they have just been really loudly for their community, for the queer community. And then I found out we had some mutual connections. So I was excited to talk more about preaching and to hear a little bit about what he's doing. And then to listen to this sermon that he sent us was incredible. I think he is really in touch with the needs of his community and does some really interesting work when we think about what it is to preach Paul, which sometimes can be a little bit difficult and confusing and has been used and abused poorly. And so it was really nice to see him take that and work with it and do it in a really special, unique way.
Yeah, I love this conversation. I love this sermon. I think the sermon itself was really moving and profound, and I was just really impressed at his ability to unpack so much theological depth and so much like church history, bring it into the current moment, and do it in a pretty quick amount of time. It's really rich and yet really accessible. And I loved in the conversation how we could kind of break apart how he makes those distinctions and decisions, and the prep process that he goes through to puts him in a place to be able to preach in the way that he does in the midst of his context.
As always, you can listen to Aaron's full sermon through the link in our show notes.
We hope you enjoy our conversation with Reverend Aaron Coyle Carr.
Welcome to the podcast, Aaron. We're excited that you're here.
Well, thanks, Anna. I am glad to be here.
One of the things we ask all of our guests is, what is your relationship to preaching?
Oh, goodness. It feels like it's been a long relationship. I discovered preaching when I was still in high school. I had started discerning a call to ministry earlier, actually, even in middle school. And let's see, when I was a sophomore in high school, my family moved to Central Alabama, and my youth pastor at the time was bivocational. He would do, 2 weeks of working day shifts at the local automobile plant and then 2 weeks of working night shifts. And so when he was on night shifts, that meant we had to cover things at youth group ourselves. And so when he found out that I was discerning a call to ministry, he invited me to preach. And I had never preached a sermon before. I had lots of ideas about what I thought I wanted to say, and I put far too many of them into that one sermon. But I remember distinctly this feeling of standing in that little, it wasn't a pulpit, it was a music stand, but standing there in front of everybody and feeling just so deeply connected to what the Spirit of God was doing in that space. Pretty deeply disconnected from the congregation because I could tell that, my peers weren't having any of the things that I was talking about. But for me, there was this incredible moment of like, oh, yeah, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And so I spent the rest of my kind of formative educational years pursuing that call. I went to undergrad at Samford University in Birmingham. And Samford has a long-standing program of sending out student preachers to local Alabama Baptist churches on various Sundays. So I preached, honestly, probably more Sundays than I didn't when I was an undergrad, which was an incredible experience, to be able to go out and experience all kinds of different Alabama Baptist churches, some that would absolutely blow the stereotypes out of the water, some that absolutely conform to some of the stereotypes. But to come into places where there was this expectation of you're a student and you're going to mess up and we don't care, we're still going to feed you fried chicken afterwards. And there was some freedom to kind of experiment with that as well. So I tried out, preaching with and without manuscripts, with outlines, various kind of styles and ideas, and eventually kind of found my own voice throughout that process, which was just an incredible gift to have, at 22 to be graduating from undergrad with, a library of sermons and all of that experience, and then to go to seminary, where I got to study with people like Tom Long, which is absolutely incredible. And then it's continued to be a vital part of my own pastoral ministry. I think preaching is important, obviously, or I wouldn't be here. But I think it's also kind of an undervalued part of the job in the 21st century. There's a lot of emphasis on pastoral care and being prophetic and even kind of organizing and congregational leadership, and all of those things are absolutely important. But all of those things, in my experience, are connect to preaching as well, and preaching can be a vehicle for those things. And so it's something that I continue to prioritize and make an important part of my own ministry life.
Thank you for sharing that. There's something so powerful, I think, in the opportunity that you were given, both like as a high schooler and in college, an undergrad. I just resonate with that. My youth group experienced the same thing, where there was like vacuums at times, where it was like, well, the students got to step up, and that meant so much for my own discernment, even though I didn't know it at the time. So, as we're looking at a specific sermon today from your context, can you tell us a little bit about your congregation in the context of this sermon that you delivered? Who are they? What are they like?
Yeah, so First Baptist Church of Moorhead, Kentucky is a small Baptist church in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. We are affiliated with the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship, which is a group that I think you both probably know very well, broke away from the Southern Baptist Convention in the early 90s. The pastor who was here at the time was kind of an instrumental architect in some of that, especially on the state level here in Kentucky. He helped to found Baptist Seminary of Kentucky and was on the board there, and also with what is now CBF Kentucky. So we have a pretty long and proud history of being, a moderate Baptist church, and truly like more, really more of a progressive Baptist church, kind of left of center. Although, in good Baptist fashion, there's probably as many opinions as there are congregants on where exactly we fit on that spectrum. Moorhead is a really interesting place. It is a town of about 7,000 people, but it is also home to Moorhead State University. And as I learned very quickly when I moved here, it is not a college town. It is a town with a college. There is some interesting tensions, but also some really good partnerships. The university brings a lot of things that you wouldn't expect in a town of about 8,000 people. It's also really funny, having lived in Dallas and Atlanta, when I moved to a town of 8,000 people, I thought I would never again complain about traffic. But every fall when the students come back, because there are about 8 to 10,000 students, I lose my mind. They don't know where the stop signs are, or this is a one-way street, and it's a fun quirk of life in a small town. We are located in like the literal middle of downtown, so we're kind of halfway between the university on one side and the major regional hospital on the other side, and we take that commitment very seriously. We've had several opportunities to sell the building and move, to, I guess you would call it a suburb, I'm not entirely sure. Other parts of town that, at least in different seasons, were kind of where the economic growth was, where the population growth was. And we chose not to take that path. We feel very much like we want to be a part of everything that's going on in this community. We're on Main Street. There's a lot of like Main Street festivals that go on during the year, and we try to be a part of as many of those as we can. We've got another one coming up actually in just a couple of weeks. So that's a little bit about Moorhead itself. The congregation is also interesting. It's a really kind of fascinating mix of a wide variety of people. I mean, you would think in a college town we'd have a lot of retired university professors, and we do. We've got a fair few of those, and primary school teachers as well. But we've also got a lot of working class folks, a lot of people who are self-taught, who are brilliant in all kinds of interesting and unique ways. So I sometimes say that we're a church of nerds, and part of that is that I am a gigantic nerd, as you've probably noticed from my bookshelf. And not everybody is a nerd in exactly the same way that I am, although they are incredibly indulgent. And I've had some surprising senior adults sit down and play Dungeons and Dragons with me, which has been delightful. But we have people who are like super passionate about taxidermy or woodworking or knitting or hiking or gardening, and just that kind of energy of like these people really care about things that are more than just getting a paycheck and going home and watching Netflix at the end of the day is really fun. So it's a challenging group of people sometimes because that kind of progressive spirit occasionally needs to be oriented towards something. Sometimes we have to stop asking questions and at least admit that even though our answers are like contingent and contextual, we have to have an answer today. And so sometimes I have to kind of poke people a little bit. But we're also growing, which is really exciting. We've been an open, well, I should say, I had a deacon tell me this the other day. I think this is better language. We are an opening and affirming church. We are learning how to lean into being a place where all of God's children, especially our LGBTQ plus siblings, can feel the love and acceptance of a church. And as a result of that, we've been kind of leaning into that stance a lot more in the last couple of years. And we have kind of had this little sort of mini explosion of queer folks in our church, which has been really cool to watch. I've done like 10 baptisms in the last 12 months, and we've had, probably 20 to 30 people join. And it's just been really refreshing to see people who are kind of done deconstructing and are now kind of reconstructing what faith looks like for themselves on the other side of some pretty traumatic church experiences, or who are in the middle of it, who are healing, who are, growing in their own sense of faith and vocation. And so in some ways, the sermon that we're listening to today kind of it touches on a lot of those themes, because for many people who are deconstructing and healing from church hurt, Paul is kind of the boogeyman. Like, Jesus is the good guy and Paul's the bad guy. And I resonate with that experience, at least kind of culturally, but I also have this profound conviction that much of what we actually like about Christianity comes from Paul. A lot of it also comes from Jesus, obviously. But Paul is somebody worth listening to from time to time. And so trying to kind of deconstruct some of those cultural caricatures of Paul as this kind of like angry old man just yelling at the clouds, is part of where this sermon in Galatians came from. So we're kind of, yeah, we're a mix of all of these things: nerds, people who have been in church their whole life, people who have come back after long seasons away, all of it. And it's all beautiful, even when it's challenging.
Thanks for sharing. It sounds like such an exciting and maybe challenging at times place to be, but it seems like you have good people there. Those sound like our kind of people too. So, what does your sermon prep process typically look like?
So our church, ever since I got here and probably for years before, follows the narrative lectionary, which is a kind of alternative lectionary that the folks at Luther Seminary put together many years ago to kind of walk through the broad arc of the biblical story. So from the beginning of the school year to Christmas, we're moving quickly through the Old Testament. And then from Christmas to Easter, we move through one gospel, almost exclusively. And then from Easter to Pentecost, there's some Acts and letters. So I really, for almost the entire academic year, kind of have the arc of where we're going planned out. And then the summer's kind of a wild card. And this sermon actually came from a summer series. We're reading the entire book of Galatians, which in retrospect, I don't know was the greatest choice, because there's only so many ways you can say you can't force God to love you by doing things. Eventually it gets a little old. But so I usually have a good sense of where we're going over the course of a semester. And on Monday, what I do is after worship planning, I'll sit down with the text for that Sunday and actually write it out longhand in a notebook. I don't know where I picked this practice up, but the idea of kind of using my body, in even if it's just my hand, to help get the text into my brain in a different way has been really helpful. And then I usually will sit with it for a day or two, just kind of mulling it over in my own head. And then all of my professors in seminary are going to yell at me for this, but almost immediately I go to commentaries and podcasts. And I know what they were saying in undergrad or in seminary. It was about like, have your own ideas about the text. But one, I think originality is overrated, especially in preaching. But two, I think of it less as like, I have to go to the commentaries so I know what the smart people say so that I can regurgitate what the smart people say. And I think about it more in line with the Jewish idea of chavruta, of like a Torah study partner, that my ideas in isolation are never as good as my ideas in conversation with other people. So if any of your listeners follow the narrative lectionary, there's a wonderful podcast called Bible Worm that I listen to every week. Excuse me. It's a Presbyterian pastor and professor and a Jewish rabbi who went to seminary together, or went to grad school together, rather, talking about these texts. And it's really fascinating. And then it gets really interesting when it gets to the New Testament. And it gets really interesting when Galatians pops up in the narrative lectionary. So some really, really rich conversations. And then after that, so Friday is my sermon writing day. I've got it pretty much exclusively blocked off for sermon writing and other kinds of like wrap-up things. So on Thursday afternoon, I'm usually off on Thursdays. This is actually a pattern I picked up in Dallas. My daughter and I go to the library, and while she is playing with the librarians, I'm sitting there with my notebook, kind of catching any last ideas and drafting an outline. And then on Friday, I just kind of sit down and write, and I try to have it done by the end of the day Friday. That often doesn't happen, as I'm sure you all know. But then, honestly, if it's done by the end of the day Friday, I let it sit and I don't look at it again until Saturday night. Just kind of get it not into my brain necessarily. I'm enough of a manuscript preacher that I'm not trying to memorize stuff. Obviously, if I'm telling like a story or there's a personal anecdote, that I feel a little bit more free with. But just kind of getting the words under my tongue and kind of feeling what that feels like muscularly, to do that. And then I might on Sunday morning take a look at it in the kind of hour before worship. But often, surprisingly often, I'm helping folks prepare for baptism. So I don't always have that Sunday school hour that I can count on. And then yeah, I'm a manuscript preacher, so I'm in the pulpit with the manuscript. I'm not, I hope, woodenly tied to it, but it's what I found has worked best for me. So
Thank you. Oh, that's so rich. And we'll link that Bible Worm podcast in the show notes. That sounds fantastic. And I've been looking at the narrative lectionary for next year, so I feel like I have some tools now.
Yeah, absolutely.
That sounds really good. So today we're looking at this sermon that you preached on August 17th, and it's titled Hagar and Sarah, based in Galatians 4, 21 through 31.
You do this thing pretty much right off the bat after the text is read, where you kind of, there's a little bit of tension in the room after we read Paul, I think sometimes, and you are just really honest about it. You talk about how it's confusing and there that this is an unusual passage. And you even say a few times throughout your message, man, I wish Paul would have said this, or I wish Paul would have made this more clear. And so you kind of give people permission to name their discomfort and their confusion about this unusual and maybe difficult or sometimes even abused text. So why did you think it was important to give people that permission to name their discomfort and confusion? Or
Yeah.
even maybe to question the biblical authors.
Well, part of it, I didn't plan this at all, but if you actually go back in the recording and listen to the reading from Galatians, the woman who did the reading named that it was confusing and uncomfortable. And so even if I hadn't planned on kind of starting the sermon with that, I think I would have had to kind of echo her sentiment, because it's exactly right. It's a confusing metaphor. Even if you kind of take the most stringent kind of literalist or inerrantist approach to scripture, which for the record I don't, but even if you do, like, it's convoluted. Like, Hagar is the law, but also Mount Sinai, but God gives the law, so how can the law be bad? Like, it's a confusing metaphor on the face of it, and people know that. Like, I want to give them credit for their own intellectual capacity, that they hear this read and they don't just sit there and go, oh yeah, that's an interesting idea. Like, they know that it's confusing and kind of I don't know if a tortured metaphor is too far, but it's challenging. So naming that at the outset, I think, is really important. But I think also, given some of the kind of larger rhetorical goals that we've already named of helping people kind of reckon with Paul, but also helping some of our folks who are kind of deconstructing and reconstructing to kind of like, yeah, this text is uncomfortable. It may, maybe not this text specifically, but Galatians may have been used to hurt you in some way. In some of the other sermons in this series, we've named and dealt, maybe not as substantively as I would in other spaces, but the fact that Galatians has, a long history of anti-Semitism in the history of interpretation. It's been used pretty violently against our Jewish siblings. This kind of very like law bad, Jesus good, and then I talk about this in the sermon too, and I think we'll get to it a little bit later, in the Reformation period. Paul and Luther get kind of conflated in the imagination of a lot of reformers. And so Galatians really becomes this text that's operating on so many different levels. And again, they know that. Like, even if nobody could name that out loud, we've all been in Baptist churches, and at least in my context, or other kinds of churches, where that kind of rhetoric of Paul and Luther sticking it to these kind of religious systems that were awful and corrupt and irredeemable. They know that. They know that in their bodies. And so I think it's really important to name that. I think it's also really important to name it because one of my kind of big goals in my sort of like medium-term visioning for the congregation is to help us work on biblical literacy, because I think a lot of times, this was my own experience, even in college and seminary, when you go through the process of deconstructing, you often kind of chuck away like all of the old tools, and you never want to engage with any part of that old edifice again. And so I grew up in a culture where like daily quiet times and Bible reading, these are really important things. And it wasn't until probably in my 30s, my early 30s, that I regained the ability to just like read the Bible devotionally again. But I feel like part of what keeps people from engaging with devotional reading of the Bible is that they come across passages that they don't understand. And rather than giving themselves permission to say, I don't understand this, they look at other people around them, especially on like social media, who seem to be getting it. And they feel like, well, they get it and I don't get it. So maybe there's something wrong with me, or maybe this practice just isn't for me. And so I'm just going to kind of jettison it. And so as often as I can, I kind of give people permission to say, this is weird, this is uncomfortable. This is even boring, but then also usually in the context of that same sermon or Bible study, help them understand that with just a little bit of effort, if you get behind the weird or confusing or boring, you can usually find something really good if you just kind of stick with it. So honestly, in some ways, it's kind of a little bit of pastoral care of like, yeah, you're right, this is weird, but let's hang with it for a minute and see if we can't kind of wrestle something good out of it in the end.
Yeah, I can see how that would be a relief for people who are sitting there feeling anxious about reading this text, interpreting this text, hearing it preached. You talk a little bit about the distance between like our world and the realities of people living in the biblical text. That's one of the big things that you also point out as maybe contributing to the confusion. So I'd like to listen to a clip from you talking about that.
Not only is it, on the face of it, a very dense piece of Pauline prose, but it also confronts us with the undeniable distance that exists between us and the biblical world. Now, if you don't know the story of Abraham, Hagar, and Sarah very well, you might have missed some of that discomfort. But don't get too comfortable in that lack of discomfort, because I'm about to tell you all of it. You're going to feel it right now. Remember that Abraham and Sarah were promised a great family by God. But by the time they reached their 90s and had no children to speak of, they began to have some questions about that promise. So, Sarah suggests that Abraham conceive a child with Hagar in order to obtain that promise in a roundabout kind of way. But here's where some of the discomfort comes. Remember also that Hagar is enslaved by Sarah, which casts an enormous shadow over her ability to enthusiastically and unreservedly consent to this scheme. And then, to make matters worse, when Sarah eventually conceives her own son, Isaac, she demands that Hagar and Hagar's son Ishmael be sent away into the wilderness, essentially left to die.
So I love this work that you do to kind of bring people back to the story that Galatians is referring to, and also to do a little bit of this work of bridging the gap, right? But as you're bridging this divide between the biblical text and our world, or maybe our contemporary understanding of the way things work, how do you determine when it's appropriate to apply, some contemporary or modern concepts, like you mentioned a modern kind of understanding of what consent or equality in a relationship would look like. How do you know when it's appropriate to bring those contemporary concepts into the biblical text?
Honestly, it kind of feels like a little bit of a cop out to say it's sort of an art, and you just kind of have to feel it out as you go. I think for me, I'm probably always gonna err on the side of one, both kind of like fully excavating the world of the biblical text while also kind of like putting it right next to the way that we understand things in the modern world. And it's not necessarily that I'm always interested in sort of condemning the choices that people in the biblical text have made. But I feel like it's really important for people at least to kind of have those two things side by side, right? That if this happened in the modern world, we would have some serious questions about it. And it's okay to have those serious questions about it happening in the biblical world, even if we don't necessarily come down on it in the same way, because we understand that we don't exist in the same historical context, you know? And with Abraham's story in particular, and with the story of Hagar and Sarah, I think it's also really important because there are folks in the congregation who have experienced sexual assault, and they've experienced it in those weird, uncomfortable ways that don't always fit into the categories on the police report. And so, naming, hey, this looks an awful lot like what we think of as being sexual assault, or at the very least, coercion, gives some permission, I think, to folks to kind of breathe a little bit. Because especially, like I've said before, if you grew up in the kind of, you know, inerrantist, literalist approach, it can be really, really hard to ever admit that the patriarchs ever did anything wrong, right? Like, if the Bible is this sort of perfect thing that can never be wrong, then it's really, really hard to say Abraham acted inappropriately here. It's really hard to say, and I mean, this seems to pop up on social media at least once a year. It's really hard to say that David acted wrongly in his relationship with Bathsheba. It's really, really hard. But it's also like people know it. Like, they look at this situation and they say, yes, a woman who is enslaved cannot, you know, she's afraid for her life. She's afraid for the well-being of her whole existence. And so she can't, you know, engage in this scheme the way that somebody else might, you know, a modern day surrogate or something like that. It's not the same. And so, yeah, naming that discomfort. And also, I think it's helpful too to remember that we are, you know, distant from the biblical text. It's not just something that I can just sort of pick up and, you know, quote, you know, Jeremiah. I'm like, I know the plans I have for you and everything's going to be great. Like, reminding ourselves, yes, that still can be true. And I do think it is true, but it's true in different ways because of the distance that we experience and because of the interpretive lenses that we have to put on. And also, I think it's just helpful to name this for folks. I try and do this as often as I can. Like, you know, there are weird metaphors in the Bible because the world of the Bible is an agricultural and a monarchical one. You know, God is a horn of strength in the Psalms all the time. And people are like, I don't understand. It's because we don't live in that same world. You know, don't ever, you know, call your beloved and tell them that their neck is like a tower set on top of a hill with sheep jumping around, because we just don't live in that sort of symbolic world. And so naming that distance, I think, it's just really important. It's helpful for critical biblical literacy. It's helpful for just kind of calming people's anxieties. It's being honest about the text. And I think above all, I want to preach the gospel. But I think very close to that, I want to be honest about the text that is helping me to facilitate the gospel, because so much of the pain that I help people through, some of my own pain, is that I sat under preachers for decades who weren't honest about the text. And I feel like if I can at least name some of those distances and confusions and discomforts, I can pass on, you know, to our kids, but I can also help our adults reclaim a faith that they won't have to recover from again, right? Like, that there's a way to go about this that is healthy and holistic and that takes the text both seriously and honestly. Illustrated Ministry has a great bumper sticker. It's got a picture. I can't remember if it's a fish or a whale on it, but it's riffing on the story of Jonah. And the caption is, "I take it too seriously to take it literally." And that's kind of a big part of how I approach the text and why I bring all this stuff up.
So you're bringing this real depth of textual understanding, and then you're also bringing in, like you mentioned earlier, quite a bit of church history and helping us think about the interpretations that have gone before us, and especially in the Reformation. And so you do that work, and then you distill the message of Galatians to be not about rejecting just the law, but a challenge against striving. And so I want to share that clip.
Galatians is a book about freedom, but it's not about being freed from the horrible restrictions of some calcified law that was never any good to begin with. It's about the radical freedom that comes from recognizing that there is no need to strive by any means, Torah or otherwise, to earn God's love. And if that's what the book of Galatians is about, then I would suggest to you that that's also what this complicated metaphor is about. The difference between striving to earn God's love on the one hand and letting go of that striving to embrace God's grace on the other. And that is where things start to get really interesting.
I find all this so refreshing. And, you know, I just preached on Romans 8 last week. And so I'm like right in the middle of dealing with this like anti-law sentiment within Protestant readings of Paul that I think obscures a lot of what he's doing about the fulfillment of law, the law in Christ, and creates some of that baggage that then we have to deconstruct from. But you're bringing a depth of exposition here that is deep. How do you gauge, right? How much of this theological background and insight, how much church history and theological digging that your congregation can absorb in one sermon?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think part of it is I am fortunate to have just a really well-read and curious congregation. And it kind of spans a pretty wide swath of the congregation. You know, it's not just folks who have advanced degrees, but even our working class folks have just a real desire to know and understand. And I think part of that is their own kind of spiritual journeys, especially the ones who are kind of deconstructing, reconstructing. It's like, what I had before didn't work, and I found it to be spiritually, morally, ethically bankrupt. So I'm hungry for a good thing that can kind of take the place of that. And so I think in some ways, it's a kind of blessing of my context to be able to kind of trust that I can do this kind of work. I think part of it too is that I don't do this all the time, right? Like, even though this was a series on Galatians, this was the only time in the, you know, almost 12 weeks that I talked about that particular history of interpretation. Like, we talked about anti-Semitism, but this whole like Reformation thing only showed up this one time. And so some of the other sermons were much less kind of dense on history and theology. And so I think it's kind of a balancing act in some ways of kind of like, okay, I know last week I went really hard on church history. So this week, you know, maybe some more pop culture allusions and storytelling rather than this kind of like letting the story of church history be the kind of narrative. But also in some respects, I think it's kind of okay to challenge folks with this a little bit. Like, even if a preacher finds themselves in a context where they might not feel like folks want this all the time, that might be true, but they still need it from time to time. You know, there are still some days when the history of interpretation or the theological depth of a passage is necessary in order to preach the gospel, right? Like, it's in some ways it would be a disservice to them to talk about Galatians without ever bringing up the history of interpretation, without ever acknowledging the harm that has been done by means of this book. So even if they don't want it or don't feel like they can hang with it, one, they probably can. Almost everybody that I've ever met in church life is way smarter than they give themselves credit for. But they also need it. Like, this is a part of our kind of spiritual vocabulary. We have to learn how to do this work again. I feel like for so long, a lot of preaching, even in the kind of progressive and theological mainline, has ignored a lot of this. And part of that is kind of like the legacy of seeker sensitivity and all of that. But I think folks want it. They want, you know, they want a sermon to say something. And part of the way that you go about saying something is by grounding it in what is real. And, you know, yeah, maybe my folks couldn't like immediately just rattle off, you know, in 15 or whatever. I can't even do it now. 1490. Anyway, nobody could like put together a whole comprehensive timeline of the Reformation, but they could at least say, oh yeah, Martin Luther, Galatians, freedom. I remember, I can kind of hang my I have pegs on which I can kind of hang this history of interpretation. So I don't know if that gets at your question at all, Evan, but those are the kind of thoughts that are bouncing around in my head.
No, it does. It's helpful. I think we're tempted to underestimate our people, and that does. I love that you use the word disservice. I really think that's the right word for it. And then it just creates problems down the road. So it doesn't mean it's easy to figure out how to navigate and include all these
Oh,
things, but I do
absolutely.
think it's
Yeah.
vital. Yeah.
So you then kind of summarize Sarah's major transgressions, and you use this phrase of striving quite a bit. So I'd like to listen to you talk about that.
You might remember that Sarah was not content to see God's promises come true in the life of someone else. And she continued to strive to measure herself and eventually her own child against Hagar and her child, until eventually Sarah's jealousy boils over and she goes to Abraham and she demands that Hagar and Ishmael be sent out into the wilderness. Abraham manages to give Hagar some food and a skin of water, but that doesn't last very long in the desert. And eventually, Hagar sets Ishmael to sleep under a bush, and she wanders away because she cannot bear to watch her child die for the relentless strivings of another.
So I love this take on the Hagar, Sarah, Abram story and how you're demonstrating kind of that these individual actions really have communal consequences, and that Sarah's, striving had impact beyond just her and her family. So why did you feel that your congregation needed to hear this message about the dangers maybe of endless striving or trying to earn grace, earn love, especially as it maybe relates to others?
On the one hand, I thought it was really important because it was the sort of way of reading this particular passage that kind of cracked it open for me for the first time. I have always struggled with this part of Galatians because, like I said at the beginning, the metaphor, it just feels so tortured. But I honestly can't remember who it was, if it was the folks on Bibleworm or if it was a different commentary. But this idea of actually, in Galatians, or in the Abraham and Sarah and Hagar story, it's Abraham and Sarah who are doing the thing that Paul doesn't want us to do. They're the ones who are trying to force God's hand through their own actions. So part of it was just kind of giving this gift to the congregation of like, oh my gosh, it finally makes sense to me for the first time ever, and I want you all to be in on this with me. But then the more I think about it, the more I think about, well, first of all, the kind of like cultural saturation of moralistic therapeutic deism, this idea that sociologists have pointed out that most people in America think that as long as you just be a good enough person, God's going to love you and everything's going to be fine. I have so many conversations with folks out and about who that's like their primary concern. Like, am I being a good enough person? Is my life good enough? And the answer to that is no, but also that's not the primary metric. Like, and especially in Galatians, it's what Jesus has done. It's not what you can do. It's not what you have ever done or will ever do. It is what Jesus has done decisively in history to make things different for us. And I think there's something just like incredibly gracious in giving folks this gift of like, it doesn't matter. Like, you can stop doing whatever thing it is. You can stop being anxious. You can stop, like, just let go of that striving because it's not working for one thing, but it's not what matters. And then especially when I think about, ministering to our queer folks, I think of so many people who have had experiences of growing up in non-affirming spaces and of saying things like, I tried so hard to not be gay or to not be transgender. I did all the things. I engaged in all kinds of other behaviors as a way to try and minimize or diminish or push down my own sexuality, and none of it worked. And some of it, in fact, had damaging consequences that I couldn't even anticipate at the time. And so that also is in my mind as I'm writing this sermon of like the ways that we strive to try and earn God's love or earn God's love via the approval of other people can be so damaging. not only to our own kind of psyches and emotional well-beings, but to our interpersonal relationships, our relationships with God, our relationships to ourselves, that to be able to let go of that or to name that that was a harm that was done to you by other people, I think is just so vital. To just to be able to say, yes, like this is where it comes from, this idea that I have to be holy and perfect. And for some people, and I think Sarah is an example of this, well, a complicated example of this. I'll talk about that more maybe. That in order for me to have a good relationship with God, I have to diminish other people in some way. To be able to say that's wrong and what was done to you was wrong, I think is just incredibly important.
I'd like to just point out like how much that cease from striving language I think is so helpful in our current context. I remember the first time I heard like Psalm 46 translated instead of be still, cease from striving, and it was like, oh, like that's very different than the way I had internalized and thought about being still. And as you then move from talking about that happening in the text to then the implications of that, like you mentioned here, of whether it's a fear of scarcity of God's love or whatever that leads us to harm one another, you bring forward what that looks like today, and I want to share that clip.
I wish you would have said it with more clarity and more compassion, but I think what Paul knows in Galatians 4 is that striving to earn God's love always issues in cruelty and harm, especially against those who seem not to have to strive, but who can, for whatever reason, embrace the goodness of God just as they are. I think Paul knows that measuring holiness always seems to demean and diminish those that somebody else judges to be on the bottom of the scale. Most of all, I think Paul knows the simple fact that God's arm does not have to be twisted into providing good things for God's children. God does not have to be cajoled or shamed or satisfied or appeased in order to love us. One of the fundamental truths of the book of Galatians is that God loves us. Full stop, end of sentence, objective theological fact.
What a crescendo. That was, for me, my favorite moment in the sermon. In fact, I quoted you on Sunday. Obviously, this has radical implications, right? And you're pointing to those radical implications of, whether it's the rise of Christian nationalism, whether it's the way our queer siblings are treated, can be addressed through what you're saying here, but you don't directly name anything. So how did you decide, or how do you decide when to be explicit and when to let your congregation make those connections? What's the benefit, maybe for you, of saying the thing or letting the implications be put together for your people?
So again, I'm going to offer that I think it is kind of an artful thing that it's harder to describe. You just, I don't know, sometimes you just kind of have to feel it out in the moment. But I think also to connect back to some of the other earlier comments, there is some balance to it too. And there's also some kind of pastoral wisdom and sensibility. Early on in my career, even early on in my tenure here, I was much more comfortable just kind of naming things and also people. And I mean, I'm still not uncomfortable doing that. But I recognize that sometimes being hyper specific can have a kind of alienating power. Sometimes it's really important. And I've done, some things like a couple of years ago, there was a Kentucky congressman named Thomas Massie who posted a Christmas card where all of his family members were holding assault weapons. And I named that from the pulpit. I was like, that's not what Christmas is about, holding weapons that can kill people. So like I still do that, but I think the more I've been with this particular group of people, the more I recognize that like hyper specificity can get in the way of what a person needs to kind of hang their hat on in that moment. And that doesn't mean that like, well, I'll say it this way. And there are lots of hooks, right? There's not just kind of like, okay, now you figure out what it means. But there's obviously, hooks in the sermon to religious judgment, to anti-Semitism, to Christian nationalism that kind of comes along with that, to anti-LGBTQ readings. But there's also some other fun is not the right word, some other interesting hooks kind of going on in the service. So, for example, the cover art on the bulletin is this really stunning contemporary portrait of Sarah and Hagar and Isaac and Ishmael, where they're both portrayed as being about the same age. I actually had somebody call me on that after the service. They were like, "Sarah's looking really good for 90 years old in this portrait." But the paintings I discovered alongside of a set of really just achingly beautiful poems about the war in Gaza and about how, at least biblically, many people kind of trace the genesis of the conflict between Jews and Arabs to this conflict between Isaac and Ishmael and Sarah and Hagar. So even in that cover art, they're kind of portrayed both as rivals, but also as kind of co-equal mothers who are equally concerned about the well-beings of their children. And that is just a really powerful angle on, I think, the whole thing. So there's another hook. Like if you're somebody who is concerned about the religious implications or the religious motivations of the war in Gaza and the ongoing human rights atrocities, there's a way for you to kind of hook into that. But if you're somebody who can't bear to think about that right now, then there are also other hooks for you to kind of pull into. In preaching class in seminary, Tom Long often used to say, "Don't introduce a snake into the sanctuary unless you can kill it by the end of the sermon." And I feel like sometimes I have been guilty of just kind of letting that snake out and not really dealing with it. And so being a little bit less particular in these kind of sharp critiques of politics or social dynamics or what have you, it allows people, I think, to kind of grapple with whatever snake they brought into the sanctuary rather than having to confront one that I have now introduced to them that they weren't planning on dealing with. But, especially if you have deep religious trauma, you bring that with you wherever you go. And coming into a sanctuary, you're already kind of primed for it. So yeah, there's a whole bunch of different kind of angles on that one question. But it's definitely something I agonize about a lot. I get comments from church members from time to time that, "Oh, I don't think that was a good idea," or, "What if a so-and-so came and sat in the church? How would they feel?" And I'm like, "Well, yeah, I kind of get that." So there's an angle of hospitality in that as well. Yeah, there's a lot of things that go into that one particular little decision.
So you used Sarah as this kind of illustration to look at the maybe consequences of striving, but then you turn your attention a little bit to Hagar and maybe some who resonate with her experience.
And not just the God who sees, but the God who sees her. The God who sees her and looks upon her and upon all of God's children with compassion, especially upon those like Hagar and Ishmael who have been harmed by the strivings of another. Beloved, I don't know what kinds of Sarahs you have had in your life. I don't know who has been so insecure in their own faith that they have demanded your pain as the currency of God's love for them. I don't know who has been so desperate to justify their own unimpeachable holiness that they condemned your faith to go out into the desert to die. But here is what I do know. Sees you. God has made a way for you, and God invites all of us, even striving Abrahams and Sarahs, to learn from your example, to let go of our strivings, to trust in God's love for all of us, and in so doing, to be fully seen by
I love this. I feel like this is the moment for me that I really resonated with the most. Especially as you're talking about how maybe sometimes the need to be theologically, doctrinally right comes at the expense of others. So it reminds me a lot of how sometimes our theological differences really can create like an us versus them. Like if I'm right, then you have to be wrong. And I really see that coming through a lot in this message. So how do you see this message of God having compassion on everyone, whether that's the Sarahs or the Hagars? How do you see this as like a response to maybe navigating relationships with people that we disagree with, or even larger, cultural conversations about us versus them?
Yeah. Well, I think in some ways, and part of the reason why I wanted to continue telling Hagar's story is that it really problematizes the idea that it has to be us versus them, right? Like Sarah and Abraham obviously continue to be the kind of primary bearers of the particular covenant relationship with God. But God also makes a covenant with Hagar and promises Hagar that Ishmael will become kind of like almost like a mini Abraham, the father of a great nation as well. And so obviously there's a divergence. You know, Sarah and Abraham go one way and Hagar and Ishmael go the other way. And, you know, rhetorically, we see some of the consequences of that divergence in the modern period. But there is this profound sense in which, you know, Sarah and Abraham continue to have a relationship with God, and so does Hagar and Ishmael. And maybe we can't always be right next to each other. Maybe we can't always be in kind of lockstep going towards the same particular goal theologically, culturally, so whatever it is. But that doesn't have to mean that we're all, you know, that there is this kind of mutual exclusiveness between us, that there can be room for, well, okay, that's your experience of God, but here's my experience of God. And that is another incredibly important part of the Hagar story that I try and lift up every time I possibly can. Hagar, and somebody maybe should fact check me on this, but I'm pretty sure I'm right, is the only person in the entire Old Testament to name God. Obviously, people call God by God's names, but Hagar specifically says, I am naming you the God who sees me. And so there's something in Hagar's own confession, in her own sort of acknowledgement of her experience, that really kind of pushes back a little bit on Sarah's experience and says, well, you don't have the exclusive claim to this. We get to be a part of this story as well. And for us, as quote, a different kind of Baptist church, pushing back on that kind of controlled narrative, I think is really important. And again, not in such a way that we have to tear down other people, although sometimes we do engage in some, you know, robust theological conversations about justice and rightness and things like that. But at least saying, hey, we also have a place at this table. Like Jesus loves us too. We're, you know, there are other ways to begin articulating this faith. And then also, I think it's so important. This is maybe veering a little bit off of your question, Hannah, but the sort of part of the rhetorical goal of telling that particular part of Hagar's story is also to name and celebrate that faithfulness within the context of our own congregation, you know, especially with queer folk, but not exclusively. But, you know, I can tell you more stories than I should be able to about people who have experienced incredible amounts of shame and rejection and death threats and all kinds of horrible social consequences just for being who they are. And if anybody had the right to just give up on Christianity and religion altogether, it would be those folks. And they're still here. They are still incredibly faithful and wanting to grow and claim this faith for themselves and to figure out how to be healthy and whole people. And it's just, I mean, mind-boggling levels of faithfulness. And it's also really beautiful because they have come to a point, that many of the people that I have in mind, where they embody that lack of striving. It's this is who God has made me to be, and God loves me exactly this way because I've tried all the other ways, and those ways don't work. The striving doesn't work for anybody. And I'm just going to embrace it. I'm going to be me with all of my quirks. And, you know, I am just, this is me. Which is not to say, and this is where I feel like some progressive churches get in trouble. Like, we still sin, we still make mistakes. Like, there are parts of us, like, there is selfishness, there's all kinds of things that still have to be, you know, brought under the lordship of Jesus. We're not perfect, but we trust that at our core, God has made us good and that we get to live into that goodness. And so, naming for those folks who have felt their whole lives, perhaps, that they're not the way they should be, that no, in fact, you are the way you should be, and that, in fact, your own embrace of your own, you know, your own image bearing, your own sort of bearing of the image of God to us is actually a sign to us of God's faithfulness. That you don't get to be, you don't have to be the problem. You don't have to be the issue about which we talk or discuss or debate, but you are, in fact, bearers of the gospel for us in this beautiful and profound way.
So a few final questions we like to ask everybody. And the first is, what are you most proud of in this sermon?
Honestly, I am the most proud of feeling like I finally understand the second half of Galatians 4. It's
Yeah.
just, it's truly been kind of like an exegetical play. I mean, I haven't been doing this for an incredibly long time, but 10 years, I've taught Galatians more than a few times. And it just feels like it's always been, I don't know what to do with the second half of Galatians 4. Let's just move on. But to feel like I finally had a kind of rhetorical, exegetical hook into this text to be able not just to understand it, but then to proclaim it to folks, that just, it feels really good when something just kind of cracks open like that for the first time. And two, to be able to share with folks, I can't remember if I said this explicitly in the sermon, but I definitely said it, around the pews afterwards. Like, I'm 35 years old. I've been reading the Bible. All of those, well, not all of them, because at some point I had to learn how to read. But like, for as long as I've been reading, I have been reading the Bible, and there are still new things that come up. And so to be able to model that for the congregation and say, yeah, like, you're not done, just because you get to a certain point, just because you get a degree or you have a job doing, like, it still happens, and it's exciting and worth celebrating. So yeah, that's what I'm the most proud of.
What a joy and a gift to be able to share that to your congregation. If you could redo this sermon, is there anything that you would do differently?
Oh, that's a good question. So one of the things that I struggle with the most in kind of looking at my preaching from like a long-term lens is I feel like I don't tell enough stories or have enough kind of like quote unquote practical examples. Now my usual counterargument when I'm arguing with myself or with other people is that I try and let the biblical story be like the main story, but sometimes I get in my feelings about it, and I've had mentors in the past who have been like, tell more stories. So I wonder, so this sermon was preached on a communion Sunday, kind of alongside Galatians. We took communion every week for the summer, which was a crazy experiment for a Baptist church. I kind of thought that the building might explode at least once or twice, but it was beautiful. If I were to re-preach it again, the odds of it not being a communion Sunday would be pretty good. So I would have, 5 to 7 more minutes to play with, where maybe I could insert, I don't know, a more contemporary example, some just another hook to kind of help people hang their own experiences on. Of, okay, we talked a lot about Sarah and Hagar striving. Maybe what does a contemporary example of striving look like in a slightly more explicit way? That might be something I would try.
So our final question, and you've touched on this throughout this whole conversation, and thank you. Why do you think preaching matters today?
Yeah. For a whole host of reasons. I mean, I think preaching is one of the spaces where the gospel is most consistently proclaimed, and that is the thing to which I have given my life, and to which the church, I think, must always be oriented. And so I will never be in a space where I imagine that the preaching, the proclamation of the gospel is not important. At the same time, I do want to be careful because I was sort of raised by people who maybe thought that preaching was important in the wrong ways, and that like the rhetorical spectacle of a great orator was what really mattered. And I want to kind of push back against that because I've also been finding a lot of joy and meaning in the kind of uselessness of preaching, with a hyphen in there, definitely. Not that preaching is useless, but that there is a kind of lack of instrumentalization that happens in preaching. It's a 20-minute piece of rhetoric that, like, yeah, you can share it, you can publish it, but it loses something in the kind of reproduction. And I know I will fully name the irony of saying that on a preaching podcast that is reproducing one of my sermons. But there is this kind of contextual, contingent, it's almost like there's a Sabbathness that comes with preaching, that this is something that doesn't make a lot of sense outside of this context. This is something that forces us to slow down. Like, when do any of us listen to the same voice for 20 minutes at a time ever? Like, it doesn't have to be my voice, but just anybody's voice. When do we focus on the same topic for 20 minutes or less? If you're Episcopalian, it's a little bit less. And it's also a gift, right? Like, I spend 15, 20 hours a week working on this. And at the end of the day, every single person in the congregation could just say, eh, I don't care, and go away. And like, that would make me feel bad. But also, that's one of, I think, the most helpful metaphors for me of preaching is I'm offering this gift to the congregation. And if it helps people, that's great. If not, okay. I didn't read the room right. The gift, I got a Starbucks gift card when I should have gotten an Old Navy gift card. Whatever. We'll try again next week. So there is this kind of like, it helps us unlearn so many of the things that I think we learn just by existing in the 21st century. It challenges our relationship to the attention economy. It challenges our relationship to consumption and production. It challenges our relationship to time and Sabbath and all of these beautiful things. And so, yeah, I mean, I could riff on this for another hour or so. I'm really passionate about kind of challenging these social norms. And I think preaching is one of our best ways to go about doing that.
Well, thank you so much. I've enjoyed listening to you preach and I've enjoyed learning from you.
Well, thanks, y'all. This has
Yeah.
been a real treat. One of the challenges of life in a small town, especially being a progressive church in a small town, is I don't have a whole lot of colleagues. Like, I've got a couple in town, but to talk to anybody about ministry, I often have to drive an hour or more. And so, just to be able to sit down and kind of nerd out about the art and the process and the craft of all of this has been a gift. So, thank you.
Thanks for listening to our conversation with Reverend Aaron Coyle Carr. If you want to keep up with Aaron and his work or listen to his full sermon, check out the links in our show notes. If you enjoyed this episode, please like and follow us on whatever platform you get your podcast and share this with your friends. You can keep up with all things Preacher Handshake on our Instagram @PreacherHandshake or email us your questions or preacher recommendations at PreacherHandshake@gmail.com. Thanks for listening and see you in 2 weeks.